Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. Americans on both the left and right share the same complaint about the mainstream media in the 21st century. Many of us see a communication structure all too reminiscent of the picture we were presented with in the 1950s of our communist enemies. They, not us, they had one official news line to the exclusion of others. It looks an awful lot like that here. A few powerful voices now rule the airwaves, not government, of course, but corporate powers these days. It is very anti-democratic. We're going to ask today, what is the place of democracy on the public airwaves? What does that mean? Today, there is the potentially very democratic internet being faced with efforts to put it under near total corporate control. One wonders how and when the media got put on such a short corporate leash. On today's show, Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest is Victor Pickard, assistant professor of the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Victor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Bert. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, Victor has been a senior research fellow at the media reform group Free Press and at the public policy think tank, the New America Foundation. Great bunch of folks there. His op-eds have appeared in The Guardian, Seattle Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, and of course, The Huffington Post. Pickard has written an insightful new book called America's Battle for Media Democracy. America's Battle for Media Democracy. In it, he reveals some forgotten battles of the 1940s when the concept of the public airways was largely defeated by a few corporations. As a result, democracy took a hit, and Pickard in his new book talks about how we may be able to get it back. Again, Victor, thanks for being with us. What was your purpose in writing this book? Why is this book necessary?
Well, the genesis for this book project really began with one big question, which is, how did we in the United States inherit this particular kind of media system, a system that in many sectors is dominated by a handful of corporations, and a system that compared to other systems in other democratic countries is fairly lightly regulated? And so as I explored these questions, it seemed to me that many of their answers could be traced back to policy decisions that were made in the 1940s.
Wow, interesting. And, you know, it's interesting how we see what we have today, but, you know, as history isn't even the past. It's here now. Am I correct that the Federal Communications Commission grew out of a near total penetration of radio into American homes in the 1930s and the concentration of the industry into what you call an oligopoly of large networks? At the time, what was understood about the concept of public airwaves, and how did the 1934 Communications Act try to address that, and what happened to it?
Sure. So throughout the 30s, especially in the early 30s, there was a big debate about what the role of radio should be in a democratic society, what should the kind of social contract be, and more specifically, what kind of ownership structure should be in place. And there was debate, very few people know this today, but there was a raging debate about whether we should have more of a publicly owned system, something more similar to, say, the BBC, or whether it should be a more commercially dominated system. And of course, I think we know how right. that debate played out. But even into the 40s, which is the period that I focus on, there were still a lot of these big questions that had yet to be determined, especially what do broadcasters owe the public in return? We're essentially giving them monopolistic rights to the public airwaves. So what do they owe society in return for that? And that, again, is this kind of social contract idea that I think emerges out of the late 40s. But going back to your question about the FCC, founded with the 1934 Communications Act, which basically gave it regulatory authority over much of our media system, over broadcasting and telecommunications. But its specific role, it was meant to protect the public interest, but that was never carefully defined until the 1940s when they tried to sort of substantiate that. And that, again, resulted in a huge policy battle that I tried to account for in my book.
Interesting. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show, Keeping Democracy Alive, with author Victor Picard about his new book, America's Battle for Media Democracy. And when one thinks of the old BBC and compared American TV with British TV and radio, theirs was less fun. And you know, if you compare the two, it was far more entertaining in America. I wonder, is it still owned by the people there? And is it? It sounds like sort of a long-term lease, that the airwaves really are owned by the public. And I don't know. I guess the question there is, what about that idea of the airwaves being owned by the public? That was, when did that come in, and is it still seen that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it sounds so quaint, this idea that the airwaves belong to the public, but in fact, it's still very much true today. It was true from the beginning. In fact, the Communications Act that came out of the 1934 legislation essentially made it very clear that the public was only leasing the radio spectrum to these commercial broadcasters. And, of course, in many cases, they're leasing it essentially for free, upon which the commercial broadcasters make a tremendous amount of money. And so this was a kind of rallying cry in the 1940s, this idea that the air belongs to the people. And many different groups, many different social movement groups got together and tried to make this sort of a shared anthem, that this idea that they were trying to reclaim something that belongs to the public and really try to make this new, what was still a new medium in the 1930s and 40s, trying to make radio live up to its democratic potential. And yes, I think we're still dealing with many of those same problems today.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case. How far we've come in history, always a good question. And concern about over-commercialization of the public airway was there, it seems, from your book, pretty much from the start. Tell us about the early origins of what we today call soap operas and public concern about their influence on the culture.
Yeah, so there was this growing public outcry that radio was becoming increasingly commercialized. Advertising was becoming increasingly invasive. They had these terms of contempt for radio advertisements. They called them plug uglies. And also singing jingles. They were just enraged that these jingles would come onto the air during their favorite programs. And of course, at this time, you did have periodic advertisements, but usually programming was sold or at least sponsored by the hour, and it was usually sponsored by some company, which would also oftentimes get involved with the actual programming, producing the programming itself. So they would sort of co-produce the plot lines for some of these shows. And that's where we get this term soap operas, because many of these radio dramas were being sponsored by soap companies. And because they had sponsored, they had paid for the production of these shows, they felt that they could run as many ads as they wanted to. And there was this kind of public reaction that, and in many ways, although I think perhaps it's not quite as invasive as it was at times in the 40s, I think in many ways we've just become desensitized. You see this with, I think you're seeing it with, like, for example, Facebook and Twitter today. At first, we become very enraged when we start seeing new kinds of advertisements pop up in our media, and eventually we just sort of resign ourselves to, you know, that's just the way it's happened. We kind of become desensitized to it. So I think in the 40s, you see still people were very upset about all this advertising on the air.
And what about the content of the show? You know, there's one thing to have, you know, there's the creative side, the artists, the talent, as it were. And then there's the sponsors. And I guess there's always a tension, no matter what the medium is, between, you know, how much say over content there is by the advertisers. That must have, was that discussion in place in the 30s and 40s? I imagine it was.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, certainly part of that raging debate was from the artists and the writers themselves. Norman Corwin, who actually just passed away a few years ago, I think he was 101, but he was a very famous radio writer, and he was often leading the charge. He's one of the main spokespeople for this critique that the artists themselves, the writers, they did not have license over their own programming, that they were constantly, if not having to give way to the advertisers themselves, they felt they were very constrained by what they were allowed to say, what they were allowed to produce. So they kept running into the kind of commercial imperatives of these broadcasters. And this is why there was this growing movement to try to create a less commercialized radio system. And I think, going back to your original question, this idea that there was this tension and that the advertisers weren't delivering to these other interests, the biggest interest that wasn't being served was the public interest. This idea, again, that these broadcasters were using the public airwaves for their own profit, and they weren't giving much of a return. And I think that was sort of at the heart of these policy debates in the 1940s.
And what about, you mentioned earlier, the contrast with the BBC. Has there been traditionally more artistic and talent freedom there, or was the bureaucracy there also telling them what to do and what is appropriate for the public interest?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't think I've never heard anyone say that the BBC is the perfect model, but I certainly have heard a lot, both anecdotally, but there have also been studies on this, that yes, the BBC certainly produces a lot more public affairs content, educational content. Interestingly, the main author of the FCC Blue Book, which is one of the main case studies of my book, something
yes.
we might want to get
oh,
into
yes,
in our discussion today.
Yes,
the main author was one of the first programming directors of the BBC. He had become a naturalized American citizen, and the FCC hired him to author this report. And he brought many of these ideas about what radio should be doing in a democratic society. He brought them to bear on this report that he wrote, the FCC Blue Book report. So you do see these logics clashing in the 1940s. And oftentimes over in Britain, whenever the BBC was being criticized, they would just point over to yeah. the American system and say, well, look, we don't want that to happen to us.
Right.
So you do see this comparison. The last thing I'll say, sure. and I came across this a lot in my research, was that in the mid-40s, you had all these returning World War II veterans, and many of them were coming back saying that they had listened to radio overseas, oftentimes BBC radio, mm-hmm. and they enjoyed it and actually preferred it to American radio.
Oh,
so this is a recurring theme in many of these debates in the 1940s.
And people, of course, don't get to really vote on what they listen to, but we're going to talk about democracy and the place of it throughout this discussion with author Victor Picard today about his new book, America's Battle for Media Democracy. And in your book, you talk about some glimmers of an alternative vision of radio in the 1940s with shows like, and I had never heard of this, America's Town Meeting of the Air. Tell us about that, please. Is there anything like that now on any communications medium?
Sure. Well, I'd like to think that the discussion that you and I are having right now is part of this alternative tradition of news media. So I would never suggest that we don't see any of that today. I would never suggest that a commercial media system doesn't occasionally produce very good content. But in the 40s, it was still not decided yet what this system should really look like, especially radio. What should radio programming really look like? And you did have these public affairs programs that were coming up, but for the most part, they were pretty scarce. And there was this media reform movement to try to make it more a medium that was characterized more by this kind of public affairs, educational content, also emphasis on local culture. And oftentimes they were trying to mandate non-sponsored content. So, of course, this is before we had PBS and NPR, but they were trying to create pockets of nonprofit, non-commercial media within this otherwise commercial media system. And that's, I think, that defines a lot of the struggle over sort of the basic DNA of what this media system should look like.
Victor, it amazes me when I hear some voices blast what they see as a liberal media domination. And I don't know about you, but aside from The Nation magazine, I just don't see it. What liberal media? And FDR's New Deal was perhaps the nadir of liberalism in America. What was the American media like then? Was it supportive then? Was it said to be liberal as well?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because it's somewhat counterintuitive. Although I agree with you that there really is not a very visible liberal media presence. Of course, some people would point to MSNBC and as you mentioned, The Nation. There are certainly outlets out there, but generally you hear conservatives complain about the liberal media.
Right.
And this phrase, this trope of the liberal media was not in circulation in the 1930s and 40s. Some people would have said at that time that broadcasters and the FDR administration had a little bit of a cozy relationship. Many people have heard of the fireside chats, and it's true that FDR, in fact, I have a picture of this on the cover of my book, that FDR had direct access to the two or three big broadcasters at that time. And that was a relationship that he didn't want to jeopardize. But in general, especially in the mid-40s when they started to purge liberal commentators from the air, certainly few people would have said that radio was a liberal medium. And no one at that time would have said that the press, that newspapers, were a liberal medium. And quite the opposite. Most people thought of the press as vehemently anti-New Deal, anti-liberal, and they were generally it was known they were owned by pro-industry people, and generally came down on a very conservative stance. Not only was the landscape different then, although it has many similarities to our media landscape today, but certainly how people thought about it was very different in terms of its political ideology.
And I'm just remembering back, one of the big voices of the 30s was Father Coughlin. Now, he was big on the radio, and he was pretty right-wing, really, and said to be kind of anti-Semitic. Did he get sponsors? Was that something that was typical of that era, or was it really unique? He had quite a large audience, I believe.
Yeah, I think his particular situation was a little bit unique in terms of this, such a huge audience. And he, I believe he was off the air by the end of the 30s, but you're absolutely right. People, even in the 40s, during the debates that I focus on, they would often trot him out as an example of what can happen if we don't have any sort of programming regulation. But there were many commentators that did have large listenerships at that time, and increasingly from the mid-40s on, they were almost all conservative. There was this real push, and this was one of the main motivations for the media reform movement in the mid-40s, that they had essentially purged liberals from the air. This is partly because of the anti-communist hysteria that was beginning to take hold throughout the U.S. that did a lot to shape our entire society, really, but especially our media system. But also, I think, as commercial imperatives were really taking hold for various reasons, they didn't want controversial, progressive people on the air that might jeopardize their advertising revenue.
Boy, and that certainly shapes the debate, you know, the debate in our democracy. And, you know, the founders of this country talked about, you know, having access to the village square, the village green, and being able to just stand on a soapbox. And that's what radio became and TV. And now we have this massive thing called the Internet. And going back a bit, your research found a special confluence of circumstances, technological, social, and political, that made the 1940s a moment when substantive debate about democratizing our media could take place. What were those unique circumstances then?
Yeah, so in many ways it was a perfect storm of these different streams, these different factors, as you mentioned. But at the same time, it was a little bit counterintuitive, because most of the New Deal radical reforms really took place in the 30s, perhaps early 40s. But by the mid to late 40s, the New Deal agenda was in various stages. I mean, people would say beginning in the early 40s. It was in various stages of retreat throughout most of government. But for various reasons, it arrived later and stayed longer at the FCC than any other section of government. And also at this time, you had all these social movement groups who apparently hadn't got the memo that the New Deal reformist agenda was in retreat. And in fact, in many areas, you saw an upsurge in activism. So I think with this, there was a kind of critical mass of progressive FCC commissioners. There was this uptick in social movement activism. And many social movement groups basically came to the realization that whatever their issue was, they had to change the media system for them to be able to advance their specific politics. So there was this kind of consensus emerging there. There was also this public disgust that I mentioned earlier about what was happening to their news media, especially radio, but newspapers as well, which is something else I focus on in the book. And then finally, as you mentioned, there was a technological change afoot as well, with FM radio coming out. Up until that point, it had been AM radio, and many reformers thought FM radio was radio's second chance, that perhaps this time they could get it right, they could make sure that these commercial interests didn't take it over before the public was able to really allow the medium to reach its democratic potential.
Yeah, interesting. FM. So FM came into being in the 40s, and I remember well into the 60s, FM was, you know, pretty highbrow, basically. It wasn't the lowbrow stuff of AM. Certainly isn't like that nowadays.
But that's true.
How did FM, how really did it come into being? It was trying to be something a bit more serving the public. What made it happen? Did the FCC force it into being?
That's right, yeah. I mean, there was various, some of it was kind of technocratic squabbling over exactly which swaths of the airwaves would be devoted to FM radio, who would get licenses. And early on, a lot of reformers thought, you know, we already have pretty much given AM radio over to really mostly these two enormous corporations, CBS and NBC. Perhaps this one could be focused more on educational content on, I mean, at this time you did have, especially at a lot of the big land-grant universities, you did have these educational broadcasters who were really trying to establish their own foothold within FM radio. And in the end, while they were able to carve out a little bit of space for themselves, this medium was again lost to the same commercial interests that had already colonized AM radio. And this was a great disappointment for many media reformers in the 1940s.
And as described in your book, there's these guys, Larry Fly and Cliff Durr. Nobody's ever heard of Larry Fly and Cliff Durr. How did their appointment to the FCC shift the commission's focus and direction? I wonder, tell us, please, about their rediscovery of what had been called the Monopoly Report and what happened as a result.
Yeah, so that's an interesting tale, and I agree with you that very few people are aware of it today. I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to, if I can't make Larry Fly a household name, I'd like to at least raise some awareness about him and his legacy. But when I mentioned earlier that the New Deal arrived later at the FCC, it really arrived with Larry Fly. FDR appointed Larry Fly as the FCC chairman, and he came in, he was known as this tough Texan liberal and had already been in a lot of battles during the New Deal years throughout the 1930s, and it really was passionately anti-monopoly. And the first thing he did, there was this... it became known as the Monopoly Report. That wasn't what people referred to it initially. But he took this report, this study that had sort of been languishing for a number of years, and he turned it into this really aggressive investigation into radio chains and seeing how there was very little competition among the big commercial broadcasters. And this report... basically allowed the FCC, this is hard to imagine today, but the FCC essentially did some trust busting and broke up NBC. This is actually how we got ABC. It broke NBC into two, so instead of two big players, you now had three. And this is something that's just unimaginable today, although perhaps... Tom Wheeler should take some notes from Larry Fly. So this was the first thing that they did, but you mentioned Cliff Durr, who came in just a couple of years after Larry Fly. Cliff Durr was actually not quite as aggressive, very different personality, but he shared many of the same assumptions about what the FCC should be doing with regards to regulating these commercial broadcasters. But what they realized that even by breaking up NBC, it still didn't really change programming a whole lot. By going from two big players to three big players, it didn't change the landscape dramatically. So then they started focusing more on programming itself, and they got into, that's where I mentioned the Blue Book.
Right.
And they basically tried to make the licenses, you know, that broadcasters get these licenses, they tried to make that more contingent on broadcasters satisfying these public service responsibilities. So they sort of changed tact a little bit, different means to try to get at similar objectives.
And that Blue Book that went into effect, when was it? And it seems like it's still at least nominally in effect, that stations have to at least fill out the form and try to say how they're serving the public interest.
Yeah, that's true, although today you have what many people refer to as the postcard renewal process, where every 8 years broadcasters have to fill out a little postcard and drop it in the mail, and the FCC essentially rubber stamps it for approval. But back in the 40s, it was every 3 years that broadcasters had to go through this approval, this renewal process. And it was up until the mid-40s, they were usually getting that kind of rubber stamp treatment. But Clifford Durr saw an opportunity here, and he called it promises versus performance, looking at what they promised to do and then looking at systematically. I mean, they're very quantitative about this. They did very careful content analysis to see how many hours broadcasters were devoting to commercial programming, how much time they were devoting to advertising, and how much time they were actually devoting to public interest programming. And as you might imagine, they found that broadcasters were doing very little of the latter.
Right.
So the Blue Book has tried to mandate this and basically said that if broadcasters don't deliver on these public service responsibilities, it will trigger public hearings and presumably they might lose their licenses, which, again, is unthinkable today. A broadcaster hasn't lost their license for public interest infractions for over 30 years. In the last 80 years, it's only happened 4 times.
So the airwaves have become a commodity, owned lock, stock, and barrel by a few corporations. That may be a slight exaggeration, but I don't know. And Victor, after it became clear that the FCC was not able to enforce the Blue Book regulations, broadcasters set their sights on the Mayflower Rule. What limits did that set on broadcasters' freedom to editorialize?
Yes. So the Mayflower Rule or the Mayflower Doctrine was something that was put into effect in 1941 while Larry Fly was still the chair of the FCC. And it basically prohibited commercial broadcasters, all broadcasters for that matter, to politically editorialize. And this sounds pretty severe today, but at the time they were very concerned, especially given the fact that most of the airwaves were being dominated by these few, in many cases, two commercial operators, that they felt that this was too much political power. That they shouldn't have this megaphone over other voices, and so they should not be allowed to politically editorialize themselves. Once the FCC Blue Book met defeat, broadcasters decided their next target would be this Mayflower Doctrine. And I should mention too, and I think we hinted at this earlier, but in the mid-40s was at this time where you saw this anti-communist hysteria really take off, and there was a lot of red-baiting, so that any kind of regulation, no matter how innocuous and reasonable it might seem in other contexts, was basically being treated as part of this larger socialist plot. And this essentially drove out many of the last few remaining progressive New Dealers out of D.C., and this Mayflower Doctrine that we're talking about was kind of the last stand, the last battle for the few remaining New Dealers. And in the end, it resulted in what we later came to know as the Fairness Doctrine, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with.
And was that a victory for progressive reform or a setback? And I wonder, I've always had a lot of questions about the the old Fairness Doctrine, which is, I believe, no longer in effect. Did it not limit freedom of the press, the traditional value there? And what about the rollback of the Fairness Doctrine? How did that affect what we see and hear today? So if you could just talk a little bit about the history of the Fairness Doctrine.
Yeah, so those are all great questions. And there are a number of delicious ironies here, because even though today, especially among progressives, the Fairness Doctrine is held up as a kind of high watermark for progressive policymaking, at the time, in the late 40s, it was seen as a consolation prize for what had been more structural, more strict regulations. Now, to be fair, what they got at the end of the 40s, and essentially people often conflate the Fairness Doctrine with the equal time rule, and they're two different things. The Fairness Doctrine was never meant simply to give equal time. It was based on this kind of two-part proposition, which is broadcasters, again, as part of their social contract, their public service responsibilities, they had to cover issues that were controversial and important to local communities, to those communities that they purportedly served, and do so in a balanced manner by presenting contrasting views, oppositional views. It didn't necessarily mean there were only two sides to a debate, but rather they had to show diverse views and voices on any particular important social issue. So that was at the heart of the Fairness Doctrine. And even though many reformers in the late 40s were disappointed by it, it was used for decades afterwards by activists on the left and the right,
sure.
Sometimes very effectively, to pressure broadcasters into covering issues, again, from a more kind of diverse perspective. So I think that was at least its immediate effect in how it changed the media system. It gave the public at least one tool with which they could try to pressure broadcasters into being more socially responsible to local communities. But then, of course, the view of the Fairness Doctrine began to change, especially during the Reagan administration.
And I wonder if the Fairness Doctrine really helped democracy or sort of undercut it, because, you know, Jefferson and so many of our founders talked about freedom of the press. And, you know, if you look back at the 19th century press, you know, they had editorials mixed in liberally, shall we say, with their, you know, reporting. You couldn't really tell the difference between opinion and news. And to require a fairness doctrine, you know, I wonder, as a kind of a civil libertarian, are liberals the better or worse now that the fairness doctrine is no longer in effect? And when did it cease to exist? I guess it was in the Reagan era, huh?
That's right. So it was revoked in 1987, mm-hmm. By Reagan's FCC chair, Mark Fowler, who you may recall famously said television was nothing more than a toaster oven with pictures. So this idea that media was essentially a commodity,
yes,
a kind of widget, and didn't necessarily serve a special purpose in a democratic society. I would suggest, I mean, first of all, I come down on the position that the Fairness Doctrine was meant to treat the symptoms of broader or deeper structural problems in the media system. So I don't think it was the best approach to creating the kind of media system we might like to see in a democratic society. But I do think it's more complicated, and it's a little bit unfair to say that it's simply an infringement on the First Amendment. And that's something that I talk about a lot in the book, about different views of the First Amendment. And there is this kind of more libertarian view that any kind of infringement on individual rights is something that we should be most concerned about. When another way of viewing it, the First Amendment is thinking about community First Amendment rights, and the idea that there should also be rights to access diverse information. So it's kind of, if you're just privileging the rights of individual broadcasters who are often voicing, or at least they're connected to these enormous corporations, mm-hmm. if we're privileging those rights over communities' rights, you know, that's problematic. And I think that's what the Fairness Doctrine was trying to address, this idea that broadcasters had an affirmative duty to serve local communities. It wasn't all about their individual rights.
Very interesting. We'll talk about this forever, really. The difference between what some see as corporate libertarianism and what you describe, I think, far better as, you know, real freedom of speech and things like that. The book is called America's Battle for Media Democracy. Our guest is the author, Victor Picard, and this is Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. And you describe a very engaged public in mid-century America, with many average citizens weighing in on the radio debate. I wonder what that looked like, and did it reflect the quality of and faith in our democracy at the time? Can you imagine Americans joining in such a debate today?
Yeah, Bert, that's an excellent question, because there are many parallels, I mean, and many important differences. So on the one hand, in the 1940s, you didn't have the Tea Party, what we have today. You didn't have this sort of grassroots libertarianism, at least not in the same sense of where there was this kind of knee-jerk assumption that government should not be regulating huge corporations.
Right.
So many of the letters that I examined from just average listeners, members of the public, that were sending in letters to the FCC and to broadcasters, they were basically, if anything, they were asking for more regulation. They were saying, please, can you rein in these commercial excesses somewhat? But if you think about it today, even though I agree that it seemed like there was this sense of civic engagement that you find in the 40s that might be lacking today in many ways, but at the same time, we just saw this past summer nearly 4 million people wrote letters in to the FCC about their open internet rules or their proposals for these open internet rules. So, I think actually when the public is aware of what's at stake, they do engage, despite all the things we hear about political apathy today. I think we do see signs of engagement, and I tend to be cautiously optimistic about that.
As do I, and I do think that, people feel powerless until they actually do something, and then they realize, hey, I'm not so powerless. You really can do something. How did Time and Life founder Henry Luce and University of Chicago president Robert Hutchins come to form the Commission on Freedom of the Press, later known as the Hutchins Commission? What was their mission? Should Luce's bankrolling of the study cast a shadow on the legitimacy of their work? It sounds like what we've been talking about. And the fact that there were no actual journalists on the commission, how did that affect the commission's findings?
Yes. So another example of a really interesting irony from the 40s that Henry Luce bankrolled this study, which was later red-baited as, again, being part of a kind of socialist communist plot. But you're right that it was compromised in various ways. And we've been up until now, we've been talking mostly about broadcast media. But in the 40s, although there were important differences, there were many similar questions, similar debates happening around the role of print media in a democratic society. And this Hutchins Commission was really where these debates kind of crystallized and, I argue, really helped define our notion of what freedom of the press is in the United States. And it's ironic that it was that the report that came out of this commission was seen by many journalists, especially publishers, as being this very aggressive intervention, when in fact what they essentially decided was that the press should remain self-regulated, and that really government had very little role to play in terms of trying to sort of set the parameters for democratic behavior of the press. So yes, very very interesting development.
And what about the fact that there were no journalists actually involved on this?
Yeah, so that's something that came to haunt them for sure, because the press was able to use that as a reason for just dismissing and condemning the report. But and they actually really debated that. They came very close to having Walter Lippmann on the report on the commission, who was a famous journalist at that time. But in the end, they thought it would give them more objectivity by not having journalists on the commission. And instead, they had the country's leading intellectuals at that time on the commission. And this really wasn't seen as a problem until after the report came out. And it unfortunately was a very convenient weapon that the press was able to use against them.
Again, Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive. The book is America's Battle for Media Democracy. Our guest today is its author, Victor Picard. And here we are well into the 21st century. And I remember in the late 60s, early 70s, looking at the future of a variety of stations, cable TV. We couldn't even imagine the internet. But you write that in these early decades, quote, old problems afflict new media. Once again, America anguishes over the diminished democratic promise of its communications technologies, unquote. And you talk about a corporate libertarian logic at odds with public interest principles. Is information a private commodity to be exploited at will by its owners? Is it a public good which, like other public goods, should be treated as a public utility, regulated and controlled for the common good? And is there any political horsepower latching on to that idea? I mean, it seems so contrary to the, you know, corporate anarchy that has existed throughout the early 20th century to get it under control. And, you know, again, some of the old problems are still here, even though we have thousands of different media outlets.
That's right. And that's a great set of questions. And I think that to get at that, I try to use what happened in the 1940s as a cautionary tale of what happens when a democratic society loses control, when the public loses control of its vital media infrastructures. And I think we're facing very similar dilemmas today around our new-ish media today, the internet. And the difference, as you noted, is that on the surface, it seems like we have so many more options today. You know, right, we're no longer right. talking about the three big networks. It seems that we have so many channels, so many websites at our fingertips. But behind that, beyond that surface level, there is actually a very small number of corporations that own and control much of this media system. And I think, again, we're facing those kinds of questions about how, given that we are already at the mercy of these monopolies in many ways, how are we going to regulate them? What is the social contract? What do they owe the public in return for their many benefits that they receive? I think this is at the heart of the policy debates that we're facing today, although unfortunately they're rarely explicitly articulated in this way.
That's true. Victor Picard, I wonder how the issue of net neutrality figures into this long history that started in the 1930s, and perhaps we need to define the term, which a lot of people don't understand. I wonder if, you know, net neutrality relates to the concept of the public airwaves.
It does. It does in many ways. Net neutrality, it's a wonky sounding term. It's kind of an unfortunate term that we have to live with today. But it essentially means that online content, that everything over the internet should be treated equally, that your internet service providers, say like Comcast, should not be able to interfere with your online content. And even though when we're talking about the content of the internet and radio programming, those are different beasts, but at the core, we are again talking about the relationship between information providers and so those who own the conduits and what they are allowed to do with the content, particularly in ways that serve the public. So we're still talking about public interest principles. We're still talking about the FCC's regulatory authority.
Right.
And so that's why I think that there are these very important and instructive parallels between what happened in the 40s and with radio and what's happening with the internet today.
And the internet giants are now lobbying Congress to make things called community networks illegal. And with net neutrality, it's like they want to have a fast lane for the people with the big bucks and a super slow lane for everybody else, which is kind of the opposite of democracy. And, you know, how all this relates to democracy in the media, the idea of community networks. What are those and what's happening with that?
Yeah, so going back to this idea, like earlier I mentioned that I thought the fairness doctrine was treating sort of a symptom of a larger problem. And in many ways, although I think net neutrality is a little bit bigger than the fairness doctrine, in many ways, net neutrality is also a secondary problem. We wouldn't be as concerned about net neutrality if we actually had competition, if we actually had multiple potential internet service providers that we could turn to. But unfortunately, most of us have one or at best two big internet service providers that we can turn to in our communities. So one alternative, a more structural alternative, and one that I certainly endorse in the conclusion of my book, is that we should be trying to create these community broadband networks that are owned and controlled by local communities or municipalities. And there are some out there that we can actually point to that have been quite successful. But as you've noted, in at least 20 states, they've set up laws that have created these legal barriers for municipalities to even be able to create these kinds of networks. And that's a big problem. It is something that the FCC is beginning to focus on. So I think that we're starting to hear more about that. So hopefully we might be able to roll that back.
And how is the FCC today in comparison to others and their concern for regulating the media on behalf of democracy?
Yes. So compared to what was happening in the 40s, this is a key difference. In the 40s, you actually had an FCC which probably for the only time in its history had this critical mass of progressives. And actually at that time you had seven commissioners, not the five that you have today. And four out of the seven were fairly progressive. And we haven't had that configuration again since then, and we certainly don't have that today. The other thing I think that you can point to is that there's this kind of market fundamentalism, this part of this corporate libertarianism that I talk about, which just assumes that the market will deliver all of democratic society's communication needs. That basically we can just leave it up to the market, and we only need the lightest kind of regulation, if any regulation at all. And I do think that assumption has been increasingly challenged.
That's nonsense, in my opinion. I'd like to end with a positive note, what people can do about it. Do you think, Victor Picard, that democratization of access to information can be renewed? How optimistic are you at the prospect of the public pushing for change in the next decade or so and having, you know, a direction in which it can go, such as community networks?
Yeah, so by nature, I'm always an optimist.
Good.
if perhaps a cautious optimist. And I do, everywhere I look, I do see the public becoming increasingly more engaged, whether we're talking about those 4 million letters to the FCC or various media reform groups. One group that I often point to is Free Press. They've been working on these issues for over a decade. They have hundreds of thousands of people who are part of their membership. So I think that there are, as soon as people realize what the stakes are, they do engage. And I think activists of all stripes need to engage with media policy. They ignore it at their own peril.
Right.
But fortunately, I think the public is waking up to it.
So one website would be, if people wanted to Google Free Press, anything else?
Yeah, that's the main media reform group out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are many media justice groups. There's Media Mobilizing Project here in Philadelphia that's very active on these issues, I think is a great exemplar to point to. But just the everyday activism that you see, people calling their members of Congress,
absolutely,
writing to the
yep.
FCC,
yep.
That's important as well.
It is. The book is called America's Battle for Media Democracy. It's just out. The author is Victor Picard. Thanks so much for being with us. Very informative and gives us power to understand it.
Thank you, Bert. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
And it's been great to have you. And let's hope that the total control that the corporations have had those days are numbered, perhaps. Always love to hear from you. Email me, Bert@bertcohen.com. Thanks for listening.